Well, I'm going to call on you if you don't talk, so you might as well talk.
Well, I'll say something. When I think back on the times I've had the kind of experience that we've talked about, as I recall them, two things stand out. The first is that it didn't seem to be about me at all. You know, I was not worried about how I was doing or what other people thought of it, or how is this going to come out? I was just doing it. And the other is that I have no sense of time. And when I thought of it, I was reminded that the fellow who writes the "What color is your umbrella, your parachute?" Which is, you know, probably now in its 25th edition or something like that. He said, as far as, you know, figuring out what you have a bent for, he said, ask yourself, what do you do where you lose all track of time? And that seemed to be in a very prosaic way the same sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. You keep moving around. Daniel and Novella and Dana. And Lisa, did you talk now? Because we just talked the other day, so I think you have not talked tonight. Is that right? No, it's not right. You already did talk.
I didn't talk. I guess what I would say is getting up in the morning and doing zazen this period, my screen just, hang on. It's okay. I can't see you guys anymore, but I've been, right after I go outside, because I kind of want to imitate that moment when we were back in the Zendo and when we would sort of go outside for a moment before everybody left. Mm-hmm. And sorry, I'm trying to get my screen back. It just
I'll explain. When we used to sit in the Zendo in the morning, then we would, partly in order to avoid talking in the Zendo, we developed a practice of we'd go out on the porch and just say good morning or maybe chat for a little bit.
So I've been doing that in my little outside porch garden thing after every day afterwards. And it feels like extending that being in the moment before I have to start my day, and then I'm not in the moment anymore. I mean, I'm rushing, you know. And it's just like it's just like sitting there, and I have my coffee, and it's just that thing of the bird flies by or the trees blow, and there's that state of mind that that lasts a little bit longer. I'm thinking about that, and I'm also thinking about this notion of creativity. Yes, when I'm in the studio, I agree with Kate, like when I'm in the studio and I'm doing an activity, it seems much more, I understand that sense of being absorbed. And also when I'm trying to teach, when I teach students, also it's like I have to tell them, like, no, don't think about it, you know. Or what, like with painting, I'll tell them, put five brushes in your hand, hold five brushes in this hand and just take one and put a brush stroke down and then react to that and put another stroke down. And everyone says, no, but that's too hard. I can't do that. I can't do that because I have to think about what I'm doing. And like, if you think about what you're doing, you won't be able to do it. Your clouds will end up like rocks rather than clouds, you know? And he keeps talking. I keep noticing that he keeps talking about consciousness. Like consciousness seems to be, I mean, what I'm understanding is that consciousness is the thing that always keeps getting in the way, keeps interfering.
But he also says, I think I closed it, and I don't know if I have the place. This is because this is what we've been reading in the morning. You know, the introduction to this section is half of it is what we read. But to arouse Bodhi mind, we have to use our discriminating human mind. Buddha's mind is beyond human consciousness, but the only way to find out what it is through conscious activity. So he also says, in Buddhism, there are lots of psychological and philosophical analyses of the self because we have to learn where we are, who we are, and what a human being is. But to see the truth directly, we have to practice. Then we can be free from where we think we are and return to where we really are and experience what the self really is. So that you need, you have to have that consciousness to, you know, react to the alarm and get up and brush your teeth and go to the cushion or whatever. You know, maybe you get dressed, maybe you don't. I mean, people, I think that I've seen people in their bathrobes. And doesn't matter. So we make a problem of it because we worry about it or we get too attached to it. You know, that discriminating mind is a mind that picks and chooses. And there's a seventh consciousness called manas, which is the messenger kind of, that goes from where the thoughts are to the storehouse, to the alaya, and picks and chooses which seeds to bring to fruition. And then gets an exaggerated idea of itself, of its importance, because look what I did. And separation, you know, and that again, there's that sense of, I did that over there, I know that over there, separate from me, that's a chair, you know, and that that sense of is the problem, but you need the consciousness, you know. Just, I mean, sometimes Mel says, you need your ego, but it ought to be just, you know, this size, and you just sort of put it down here. And I say, yeah, and it should not be a beach ball that you're holding on your lap. Just a little, softball over here.
Yeah, it's like we've got this incredible machinery that does all this fantastic, wonderful stuff with our brain and our mind. But then it ends up being this big unwieldy thing that gets in the way also.
That's right. Well, and that's what we're practicing, you know, and staying with your body. And you can feel it. You can notice when you start to grab after things sometimes. Thanks.
Well, I'll go then.
Okay.
The short of it is I felt it on a lot of occasions. You know, and in the darndest of ways, including in the practice of law sometimes, when I'm in the flow of a deposition or whatever, something is just, it clicks and it's fluid. And so a lot of things are coming to mind for me tonight when we're talking about this. So I remember about maybe 9 years ago, I took on a case, and it was a contract dispute between two huge companies. And I took this case on the eve of trial within 3 weeks for a friend. And to make matters worse, the guy behind my client, behind the company, he was one of the most renowned attorneys in California. And anyway, so it was venued in San Francisco. And of course, I am venued here in Sacramento. And so it's the day of trial. And I have to wake up at about, I don't know, 3 o'clock in the morning to ensure that I'm at the San Francisco Superior Courthouse in time. And so I take off and I load my car with the banker's boxes and all of that stuff. And, you know, like 12 of these things. So my car is unwieldy on the road. And there was this full moon. And I just remember driving to the courthouse, and I'm thinking of everything, opening arguments. Oh, I'm pissed at the other guys and, you know, nervous and scared for myself. And I felt this way all the way past Vallejo, all the way across the Carquinez Bridge. And, you know, then I'm finally winding my way out of the coastal mountains, and I'm right there on the bay, and all of a sudden, boom, there's the moonlight full on the bay.
Yeah.
This giant moon. And I was awestruck. And it's exactly as you're characterizing it. It was just, you know, and then it's like, oh my God, this is the most gorgeous thing. I have to write a poem about this. And I did write a poem about it. So it's weird. I think that the most pronounced way that I feel this is playing music. And my instrument, I'm a classical guitarist, and there's so many things, you know, my fingers are part of my instruments. My nails have to be shaped right. The humidity affects the guitar, you know, and then I'm always scared about me messing up, and it goes on and on and on. And, you know, when I start to focus on any one of these things, I can just feel everything fall apart. But then there's just some days when, and it's due to practice, that it's all fluid and it's clicked. And I wouldn't characterize it as me being entirely absorbed in the instrument or whatnot, because there is a level of consciousness there, but it's not so big that it's getting in my way. And, you know, if I really let that ego step in, which is really me being scared to make a mistake and to go off the rails with a live performance, you know, that's when I start to make mistakes. And so that's how I practiced music for, you know, 30 years almost. It was just like I had to practice through all my pain and fears. And whenever I'd mess up, I would just continue to practice more and more and to beat myself up. And so like what Kate was saying, what really helped a lot for me, it was just to sit. And now, you know, I like hearing some of the things like I hear, if you're going to play guitar, just play guitar, you know? And if it starts to bother me, then I just put it down and walk away from it rather than always trying to grasp at it at this point. But as we've heard, you take me out of it as much as possible, and that's when things are easiest.
Novella, was that you wanting to talk?
Well, not really, but I think as it relates to our subject, you know, I've been struggling. I didn't do the reading, but from what I'm gathering, trying to find that space of fluidity and ease Well, I'm trying to prepare. The reason being is I am trying to prepare to do a talk on Sunday for an hour on the autumn and the lungs. And I'm just so nervous about it. And then I get to, you know, doing my research and reading, and then I find that, okay, you could just, you know, this is in you and it's just going to flow. And I know we've talked about just stepping into it without thought. And, but then, you know, letting it, I know I'm supposed to present material, so that's also important. So that's kind of where I'm at and what I'm practicing with right now. I'm practicing with preparing for a talk on the autumn as it relates to Chinese medicine and the lungs. And that's it.
Yeah, I haven't had any vast experience of feeling that I have disappeared, but probably what we're talking about is something very ordinary that Katagiri's language, romantic language, makes me think. I've never done that, but it's probably that I'm getting caught by that language, because I certainly know that when I write for work, there are times when I just get into the flow and time does seem to compress. I wouldn't say that I disappear, but I gain confidence and momentum in what I'm doing. And that's contrasted with times when I'm writing something and I'm really worried about my audience. If I'm worried about my audience, that means I'm worried about myself. You know, if I'm worried that I'll communicate to somebody, I'm objectifying them and making them separate from myself. But if I'm not as concerned about that, then often there is less of a sense of me as well. I think I've had that playing guitar as well. Similarly, if I worry about making mistakes or worry about the performance, there's so much me and so much audience that there's no flow. So that seems to be my experience with that. So. What's that?
So, Dana.
Okay. So I have a lot of thoughts, and I wrote so much in my book, and I really deeply listen to everyone. And it's almost hard for me to even say anything because I've so really love this topic. But a lot of things are kind of coalescing and coming up for me. And it was, I can't say it right, Dogen.
Yeah.
His writing where he says, you're at the top of the ocean and your feet are touching the bottom at the same time. Mm-hmm. And it kind of seems to be a theme through, and it doesn't manifest through the writing in a way that says to me, by showing up, here we are, the pivot of nothingness, time and space, here we are. By showing up and trying our best to be absorbed in the present moment, and when that's too hard to bounce between the two worlds, sort of say, to be in touch with the universe or God or true source, absolute source, and then also have your feet on the ground in your everyday life, in the action of our everyday life, to manifest the truth, the dharma of our lives, I guess. And I'm thinking about activity and yet stillness, because we're sitting zazen. And so much of the time what I get absorbed in is doing nothing. I sit in the garden and I will watch the birds for hours and go, oh my God, it's been 2 hours. I've been watching birds. I love to watch birds and observe where they go. And I arrange my yard in a way where they have perches. And like I have an aviary in my yard for them. And that's what I love to do. And when I do my job, it's the tyranny of perfection. You know, it's actually very hard for me to show up for my job every day because of it. And the only way I survive that kind of perfection, because I'm sort of a dreamer, is to go, I can do this. I can show up for this moment, this moment, this moment. And I, you know, walk away, take a breath and come back. You know, so I'm constantly learning all the time just to survive this really, really complex job. And then I signed up this week to do DOAN. So I'm learning that too. Like more to get, you know, not exactly right. But all of this to say, I had sort of had this reflection today of, in the past when I was a child and I was completely absorbed in something, because I saw a picture of my mom as she was probably 20, and I had forgotten she had red hair and little red ponytail. And I saw this picture of her and I remembered the smell of her hair and touching her long red hair, and now she shaves it off. And then she called me and her voice was old, and it's so like time was just kind of all smashed and like sliced, like we had read on the thing. And so I've just become, I feel like this book and this study together, it's just showing me the malleable nature of time and how important it is to just show up for the moment wholeheartedly again and again. It's so hard to do. And that's what my, that's what my intention is for this whole zazen, is just to stay with my breath and try to stay in the moment and trust, have faith, the trust, you know, that I'm on the right path, you know. I guess that's all I can think of.
Does anybody have anything else or any questions from this reading, this these sections of zazen shin or... anything, you know, Zazen Shin, which is the chapter 23, that's the poem that our, the quote in our brochure and on our homepage, I think it is, it comes from the water clear all the way to the bottom, a fish swims like a fish. So, yeah, Zach.
I think it might have been in that chapter, but where he talks about body and mind in a way that sounded a lot like form and emptiness in the ocean and the waves. And I found that kind of helpful. I mean, I don't know that I could describe why, but body and mind seem separate but not separate, and that put it in a way that seemed a little more digestible. Because I like form and emptiness, you know, in the Heart Sutra, that whole back and forth. And thinking of the ocean and the waves, it's kind of poetic, but it describes it in a way that I can relate to.
And well, and also back to Zazen, as you said, you experience that. You know, that your mind is creating thoughts and emotions, and your body, you notice that your body is feeling them, and that they change constantly. If you allow them to arise, then they will also pass away. And you say, oh, there's emptiness right in my very body and mind. You know, and you don't have to you don't have to think about it that way, but you experience it. And your body knows. And you can play with it. I mean, you start to smile and, you know, you feel happier. That seems weird to me, but it's true. And please don't try the laughing part because you'll drive everybody crazy. It's really hard if you're sitting zazen and somebody starts to laugh, because it's very hard not to start to laugh, and everybody, it's just weird. And crying doesn't do that for some reason. I mean, you may be crying, nobody will even hear it, but even if you hear it, it doesn't tend to make you cry. But if you're laughing, you can make yourself laugh too. I don't know if you start by doing it in a fake-o way, and pretty soon you're laughing. Anyway, yes. Here it is. I think this is because I had written at the bottom of 144 into 145. It's if you try. I love that he's talking about try, because, you know, one of my mottos is trying does not work, right? If you try to observe yourself as your subject into activity as your object, it is not total absorption. In the beginning, you have to try, but you cannot do it halfway. To be completely absorbed, you have to devote yourself totally with sincerity, and then you can be absorbed. You can see the unity of your body, your mind, and your object. And that's a kind of faith. You have to, you know, you have to try it on. You have to have the faith to try it on. And, you know, sometimes in zazen, you have to work really hard. You know, you kind of have to take yourself by the hand, or even, you're like, stop it. You know, and you have to work at it consciously. And then sometimes, often, you settle and there's just breathing. So I think of that as faith. That's what I wrote in the, and I thought of you, Zach. I wrote faith in the margin. I see you, Steve, just a second. And then also in 146, when you don't have confidence, the oneness you experience is relative truth. When confidence is always with you, oneness becomes absolute truth. To have strong, stable confidence or faith every day, you must concentrate yourself on making the effort to constantly approach and penetrate this very moment. That's one of those ones where I think that's true, but I just don't think that confidence or faith is going to be always with you. You know, we have that intention, but and sometimes it happens, but and we need to maintain the intention, but don't set yourself up. Say, oh my God, if I am not completely aware and in touch every moment after moment, then I'm a failure. No, I don't think that was true of Katagiri, and it's not true of anybody that I know, including the various sort of Zen master types. Steve, what was it that you wanted to say?
Yeah, I've been actually coincidentally highlighting in the book moments where he talks about faith, which I feel like has touched me the most. It seems like there have been not that many moments where he talks about faith, but it seems like he has some real nuggets of wisdom. So before I read it, I'm going to kind of set up where it was going. He was talking about consciousness coming, like you're doing something and your consciousness touches the moment that you're doing directly, and then you come back and you reflect on it. And you say, oh, I was there. I hadn't really realized I experienced that until recently, when I realized that the moments go by so fast. And so the fact that I have a physical sensation, I don't actually notice a sensation at the same time as I have it. I notice it a second later or a moment later or something like that.
Yep.
And so the first quote that that I love on this subject is, as long as you touch the moment, it's wisdom. When you return to the dualistic side and know that you touched it, it's not wisdom. It's faith. In the dualistic world, wisdom turns into faith. So I hadn't thought of faith like that before, as touching the moment and then reflecting on it. I had thought reflecting on it is sort of a failure to stay in the moment, but actually it's faith. I have another one I think I can work up. Do you want to have feedback on that, Mary, while I look up the next one, or should I just go on?
Well, no, I don't know that I would describe that as faith. I mean, maybe what you're doing in that moment of reflecting, you know, of separating yourself and reflecting back, is you have faith in your experience. I was going to say recollection, but I guess you could say that. But faith in your experience that it actually happened, and then you can let it be what it was, and go on.
And yeah, that's how I take it. I take it in the sense that that or my understanding of faith in Buddhism is that it is based on experience of your within your own experience sort of grows and then gains a momentum, and that inspires you to do more of it. You know, I sat zazen the first time and maybe it was pretty bad, my mind wandered, but there was a couple of moments where I noticed my breath, and so I decided next time I'd do it again, and now it's a habit. And some kind of faith keeps me doing. And yeah. I think he kind of puts it together in the second quote that I selected, which is quite a bit farther in the book, but it was in the part we were reading. I'm not sure what page it's on because I'm in Kindle, but he says, religion usually requires you to believe first and then act. But in Buddhism, to act is simultaneously to believe. So day by day, your zazen must be refined again and again. And to me, that's like a restatement in more poetic terms of what I was just kind of riffing on, that you know, I don't think of myself as a person of faith. And if you were to throw me into a Christian milieu, it would say I don't have very much faith. But I feel like at some point, another teacher, Jerry, pointed out that one of the things that she saw in me is my faith. And I thought, what are you talking about? And the more, you know, I absorbed that, the more I realized actually that's true. I just keep coming back because I'm slowly, maybe like Suzuki Roshi mentioned about walking into the mist and you don't realize that your clothes are getting wet. You know, I kind of feel like that's been my experience with them, and that's how I would describe faith for me.
Yeah, and the, you know, and what you're describing is also what's depicted in the Lotus Sutra and the faith discernment parable about the prodigal son.
Right.
And it's almost 10 after 7, and so I think it's time to stop. So if ever you want to know, I talk about that all the time. I don't feel like repeating it. But if you want to know, if you don't remember or you never heard me talk about it, let me know, and I'll tell you the story of the prodigal son and what that has to do with faith. He was exercising his faith muscle. Okay? We need a clunk.